Omar dreamed of raising Palestine's flag on the international podiums. But Israeli bullets shattered that dream, ending his life and leaving behind silence where cheers once echoed.
Ammar left the house around noon to buy juice. He promised he would be back quickly for lunch. But minutes later, Israeli force opened fire. A bullet hit him in the back. The Israeli intelligence called us and said, "Your son is with us, lightly injured, but he was dying."
As villagers rushed to rescue Ammar, the Israeli soldiers held them back. It took over an hour for an ambulance to reach him. By then, the damage was done. Ammar died on the way to the hospital.
Everyone in the town tried to reach him, but we were blocked. The ambulance was delayed. The roads were closed. He died in the ambulance. My child, my little man, I still can't believe he's gone.
Ammar was the youngest member of his Muay Thai team. Having started at the age of 9, he traveled, trained, and won medals, his eyes always fixed on the future.
Maybe it's forbidden for our children to dream. There's always occupation standing in their way. Ammar, my child, was one of them. They murdered his childhood, just like they do with so many others.
Ammar's teammates share their feelings too about his martyrdom.
Ammar was like a brother to me. When he was martyred, it broke my heart. Life with him was full of laughter. He was like a flower, always dreaming of raising Palestine's name high.
Ammar's gloves now rest quietly in a drawer. His medals hang without pride. His dreams were not too big, but the walls, guns, and soldiers that surrounded him were.
Ammar Hamayel was not just a boy. He was a future, a fighter, and a dream. And though his last match was stolen, his story will not be forgotten. Naqa Hamid, Kufr Malik, Occupied West Bank.
A memorial ceremony in Tehran to honor the martyred IRGC commander, Lieutenant General Mohammad Said Izadi, a national hero who lost his life in the recent Israeli aggression against Iran. The ceremony, filled with a sense of gratitude and deep admiration, serving as a poignant occasion to remember the sacrifices he made in the fight against the Israeli regime and in strengthening the resistance front.
His name shines brightly among those who fought against the Zionist regime. His cause and ideals remain vibrant, and his blood continues to strengthen his path more than ever.
He was a remarkably strong individual, unwavering in his commitment to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution. For many years, he dedicated himself to serving the Palestinian people, and his legacy continues to endure.
Throughout his service as an IRGC commander, he collaborated closely with all the prominent figures of the resistance front. This remarkable leader worked relentlessly to gather vital knowledge and technology, fortifying the resistance movement and establishing an enduring impact in the battle against adversaries.
Lieutenant General Izadi's tireless efforts in securing the necessary expertise, technology, and resources have strengthened the resistance front, leaving a lasting legacy in the fight against the enemy. Farzan Hashimi, Tehran.
A 2024 report by the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics indicates that over 60% of West Bank farmers face difficulties in marketing their products due to checkpoints and movement restrictions imposed by the occupying Israeli regime. The real hardship began after October 2023 due to the escalation in the occupation and Israel's control over more areas of the West Bank as part of the regime's expansionist agenda.
Many events occurred after October the 7th of 2023 for farmers, as Palestinians turning to farming doubled, leading to more goods in markets and a weakening of demands. Traders benefited from the scenario, but the biggest loser was farmers, who could sell their goods at low prices despite investing more on their farms.
Khalil Atallah is experiencing a potent blend of fear and exhaustion due to the widespread checkpoints and road closures in the West Bank. He witnesses the deterioration in agricultural products before they reach the central market, forcing farmers to sell their goods at very low. This situation is compounded by a significant drop in daily sales, further jeopardizing their livelihoods.
The roads that used to take 2 hours to reach now take a whole day. The farmer gets high-quality goods from the central market, but the goods arrive in local markets in bad quality, often withered and spoiled due to checkpoints. This affects both farmers and traders due to the high cost involved and low prices when they sell.
These days, we're suffering from water scarcity, as there were not enough rains last year, only a third of the annual average of rainfall. With the occupation's restrictions on water and preventing us from digging wells, this leaves farmers with no water, and even the rise in fertilizer prices keeps them in difficult situations.
Despite extended blockade from roads to markets, Palestinian farmers in the West Bank remain steadfast, but with the continuation of these restrictive policies can lead to food insecurity in the occupied territories.
Farmers in the West Bank face many challenges that affect their livelihoods and agricultural production. Israeli imposed movement restrictions, insufficient access to land and water resources, destruction of farming properties, and the impact of Israeli settlements are just some of those challenges. Tiba Asi, Occupied West Bank.
In support of the oppressed Palestinian people and their heroic resistance, the naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces have targeted the Eternity Sea ship, which was heading to the port of Om al Rashrash in occupied Palestine. The attack involved an unmanned boat, as well as six crews and ballistic missiles. The operation resulted in the complete sinking of the ship, and the entire operation was recorded. Following the operation, a group of the Yemeni special forces rescued a number of the ship's crew, provided them with medical care, transported them to a safe location. The targeting of the mentioned vessel came after the vessel itself and its operating company resumed operations with the port of Om al Rashrash, in clear violation of the ban on operations with the Om al Rashrash port. It also came after the vessel refused calls and warnings from the Yemeni naval forces. The Yemeni armed forces affirm their continued prevention of Israeli shipping in the Red and Arabian Seas. They reiterate their warning to all companies dealing with the ports of occupied Palestine that their ships and crews will be targeted in any area reached by the armed forces, regardless of the destination of those ships. Out of concern for the safety of ships and their crews, we reiterate our warning to companies and countries against the consequences of dealing with the Zionist entity and sending their ships to the ports of occupied Palestine. This stance aims to compel the Zionist enemy and its allies to lift the siege on our brothers in Gaza, halt the aggression against them, and end the ongoing genocide against them which is taking place before the entire world. We will continue our military operations in support of the oppressed Palestinian people and their steadfast resistance which defends the entire nation, until the aggression against Gaza stops and the siege is lifted.
Almost 58,000 people have been killed by the Israeli regime in Gaza since the start of the genocide. Now, 187 civil society organizations and trade unions from across Europe have published a joint letter demanding that the EU suspends all official ties with Tel Aviv, a position backed by many EU legislators.
Iran replied to an Israeli illegal attack by bombing Israel. Okay, it's easy to condemn Iran, as you have done time and time again. But over the last years, Israel has bombed, what is it, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Sudan, Yemen. Of course, Palestine is illegally occupying Palestine, parts of Syria, illegally occupying parts of Lebanon. Are you able to condemn this?
Islamic Republic of Iran.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is being accused of acting as a tool of the US and Israel in an effort to discredit Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. Simultaneously, many EU lawmakers say the West is complicit in Israel's campaign to starve Palestinians. People on the streets of Brussels seem to agree.
A lot of people are dying, a lot of kids. It's not a good situation.
I think the Israelis are scum of the earth.
It's a
tragic crisis, no matter how you look at it or how you describe it.
I hope one day it will be better for them.
It's suggested that EU political leaders are enabling Israeli aggression because they fear upsetting the United States.
In fact, instead of holding Israel to account, President von der Leyen has Netanyahu, a war criminal, on speed dial, and she's actively encouraging to carry out illegal strikes on Iran.
Fresh calls have been made in the European Parliament for EU countries to close their airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu and enforce the arrest warrant issued against him by the International Criminal Court. Critics argue that the EU's credibility is in tatters due to its glaringly inconsistent foreign policy, imposing 18 rounds of tough sanctions against Russia, yet failing to take any meaningful action against the Israeli regime, despite an ever-growing catalogue of atrocities. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A potential diplomatic thaw may be on the horizon between Iran and the United States. This, according to Iran's top foreign policy think tank, the Institute for Political and International Studies, IPIS. Experts examined the high stakes and uncertainties of renewed Iran-U.S. diplomacy.
There are many ambiguities, but also there are many things that, you know, we can talk about, including Iran's consistent policy of trying to keep peace. We are an anchor of stability in this region. We are a civilization. We have been here for millennia.
Participants reiterated that Iran remains committed to diplomacy, but trust has eroded.
As you saw, they were attacking all our nuclear sites, which were under IAEA constant monitoring and under the safeguard, which is the grave violation of international law. We tried also to be very measured and proportionate in our response to this aggression. Our act of defense was under Article 51 of UN Charter, but at the same time very much strategically calculated to avoid the spread of this war to the Persian Gulf and to our region.
The events also shed light on the recent geopolitical miscalculations by Israel and the United States and their failure to achieve their strategic goals.
Iran is still trying to be measured, and also trying to be very calculated. But God forbid, if the day come and they pose any existential threat, as they sometimes you are hearing from the other side of the Atlantic, then Iran will be a different Iran. What Iran did by showing the capacity and capability of targeting, even by informing them that we are going to attack different sites, and we did it. It was a manifestation of the will and the capacity of Tehran, and this very strong message that enough is enough. Our region is very much exhausted and tired of these violations and war, and we hope that the others have got this message clearly.
According to the speakers, Iran's measured military response has shifted the narrative, forcing a reassessment in Washington. As this webinar underscores, Iran's resilience stands firm. While Israeli and U.S. objectives remain unmet, it is Tehran now that is charting its own path forward and changing the narrative. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
For the first time since launching its military operation in Jenin camp in late January, Israel has allowed 25 Palestinian women to briefly return to the camp. The entry was granted in coordination with the Palestinian liaison. However, three of the women were still denied access despite prior approval.
A soldier stopped us from going in, even though we had coordination. I only wanted to enter the camp, see its streets, its alleys, and my home. I wasn't going in to collect belongings. It's been 6 months since we were displaced. We haven't seen our homes. We used to stand on the edge of the mountain just to catch a glimpse. They forced us out, and we were left with nothing.
Among those who was allowed to enter the camp was Sahar Abu Zaini, who was displaced several times since 2020.
We have lived through many rounds of displacement, but this one is the most painful, both in terms of the days we are enduring and the number of martyrs and the wounded. Also, we carry the weight of what's happening in Gaza, which surpasses even our own suffering. We ask God for strength and compensation for the pain we face.
This isn't just about demolishing buildings. The Israeli regime is trying to reshape life in the camp entirely. The demolished houses represent entire lives and memories that the regime has erased.
The situation in the camp isn't like it used to be at all. All the houses are damaged, destroyed, and affected. My feeling is a mix of joy and sadness. I saw my house for the first time in 6 months. It was heavy when I returned to my house and saw it, even though it was badly affected, but we hope to return to the camp and rebuild it again.
Across the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinians continue to face forced displacement and the destruction of their homes. But despite all that, they remain determined to stay on their land.
The occupying Israeli regime is changing the entire life structure of the residents of the Jenin camp by altering not only the physical space, but leaving the inhabitants, who are deeply attached to the camp, with no alternative options to make their lives sustainable. Tiba Asi, Occupy Jenin.
Thank you. Greetings, dear listeners, and thank you for being with us on Iran Radio. I'm delighted to unveil what's ahead in this upcoming hour. We begin with Islamic Upbringing Guides Parents with Faith-Based Wisdom. This program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. After that, we'll feature more of our radio productions. Next, we journey into a brief commentary on supplications with Bridge.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Iran Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host Zainab, and with me is joining Brother Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
And a very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, in this program, we listen to your curious questions and discuss the very pressing topics of Islamic upbringing so that it can help you nurture the faith in your children from the very beginning. And the answers are rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the traditions of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the narrations from noble imams. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon them. So, Brother Liaqat, we discussed honesty and we discussed respect for parents in the previous two episodes. And now we want to discuss the other point that you told us from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. That was compassion and kindness. We know how kind Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam had been, but how it can be like more tangible and be related in the lives of teenagers.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam were compassionate even to those who opposed them, yeah?
Right.
Even in the last moments, Imam al-Hussein, alayhi salatu wasalam, he would be after nijat of the people. Like, he would say, don't kill me and do not wet your hands with my blood.
Right.
Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to throw you with your face towards the hellfire. And of course, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam emphasized treating everyone with kindness regardless of the differences, you see. And in our life examples, I would say the example of Masjid, the example of Husseiniyah, yeah, where there are people, the elders especially, who are kind of too harsh upon the younger ones, yeah, or even the adults, those who are old.
Right.
They use harsh language. They're not kind, okay? In the Husseiniyah, in the Masjid, they are like, they taunt others. Oh, why are you doing this? Unfortunately. Even we can see examples like the teens or the children telling about their parents, like, I hate my father or I hate my mother, because they use long. Yeah, there are a few qualities which
right.
I don't like. So that's the reason I hate them, because
right.
they always used to hit me. I hate them. I hate them because my father hits my mom, example, unfortunately.
Right.
Or I hate them because I always see arguments between them. I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. And the list goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So over here, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam were kind. Okay. Where were they kind? If we see in the life of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, there were people who had this quality of hatred towards them, that is the
right.
Ahlul Bayt. Example, the uncle of the Prophet, number one. There were children from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, so they had children, like example, Jafar or Kazzab, okay? The son of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. The brother of Imam Hassan Askari and the uncle of Imam Zamana, ajallahu ta'ala farajhu sharif, whom the Imam has cursed. Yeah, the
right.
Imam of the time has cursed his uncle. This is just an example, okay? Cursing over here is another story. Why did he curse is another story. And the expression or how the imam, like the 10th imam, would speak to his son, that is Jafar, what is another story now. Okay. When the imam curses, why is he cursing? Number one. When the imam, like the imam, the 10th imam, is showing love and kindness towards his son, Jafar, who is definitely a cursed one and he was going to enter hellfire for sure. Why is he showing respect and kindness, example, towards his son is another story. The wives of Prophet Nuh, Prophet Lut, and also another example what we see is the wife of Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wasalam as well, who killed Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Kindness can be seen in the family of Ahlul Bayt,
and we will explore that a little more after a short break. The listeners, don't go anywhere.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman, don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Iran Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing and Brother Liaquat is here. So Brother Liaquat, you were telling us the kind and compassionate behavior in the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, even in the times of like when they were not met with the people who were not compassionate or who were not even having the basic traits of being Muslims.
So I would say like even in the families of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam, we see this quality of being kind to those people, okay, who were not kind to them, okay? Example, the Prophet. There were a few wives of the Prophets. Unfortunately, they were rude. They were harsh upon the Prophet. And they would also, like, disclose secrets, what the Prophet used to tell them, to the other example, other lady or the other wife example, okay? So, over here, we see them, that is the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam, acting very kind and very compassionate towards them, okay? The curse is because of their troublemaking towards the Ahlul Bayt.
Right.
Example, now, the wife of the Prophet created a mess or created a big trouble to the Prophet.
Okay.
And definitely made the Prophet sad, okay? If we consider, Prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or even Prophet Nuh or Prophet Lut alayhi wasallam, okay? Example, okay? They have made the Prophet angered, okay?
Saddened.
But of course, sad and upset. Of course, the Prophet didn't show his anger. That's another story. It's his quality now. Okay, the curse upon the wife, example, over here, or the curse upon the son of the imam is because of his quality that he's troubling the imam. You see, this is the curse. Even if no one curses this particular person who has made the Ahlul Bayt sad, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is definitely going to curse this person and he's going to throw him into the hellfire. Okay?
Right.
But when a person is troubling the Ahlul Bayt, what is their reaction? Is what we have to see in our lives right now. Example. Over here, the father is troubling the son. He's shouting or he's hitting his mom. He's scolding his mom with all the bad language, with all the bad words, foul language, and he's creating a mess every day, almost every day. And now the son or the daughter, they are like, oh, we hate our father, okay?
Right.
They have all right to hate their father, like, definitely. Like, it's, we can say they have a valid reason to hate their father or mother. Anyways, I would say, does this mean that they should stop acting kindness towards their father or mother? No. Of course, there is this hatred towards their parent, Okay, this is one part of the story, but that doesn't
even if that's on a valid point.
Even if they had a valid point.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean that the hatred should be shown in any manner. Example.
Right. And we'll head to the examples after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
Regarding the saying of Allah the Exalted, أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا, save yourselves and your family from a fire. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, teach yourselves and your family righteousness.
Welcome back. You're listening to Iran Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat is here with me. We're talking about the compassionate and kind behavior that we learn from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam towards children, and also the vice versa, how teens should be behaving kindly and compassionately to their parents. So Brother Liaquat, you were saying that even if you have a valid reason to like sometimes hate your parents, because we hear those stories, those questions from the teenagers like, I hate my parents because of this particular thing. So even if their points are valid sometimes, but you are saying this is not enough to show hatred in return. This is not enough to not behave compassionately and kindly.
Indeed, definitely. Because from the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, from the lives of Ahlul Bayt, we don't see this. Even when the Prophet was disobeyed completely, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was like, okay, O Prophet, why are you making haram upon yourself something which has been made halal? Still Allah, but it's a choice upon the Prophet to leave those people, example.
Right.
And the Prophet chose not to leave them.
Right.
Okay. This was his compassion. This was his kindness.
And that's why he was told that he was assigned with the title of having khulqun azim. He was having the very great kind of moral ethics, and he possessed those moral values.
And of course, you know, there's a small point over here which I want to add for all those spouses who are listening to this particular recording. I would say, even if there are issues in your family with regards to like marriage, relationships and stuff, do not leave each other. Unfortunately, in today's world, leaving each other has become something very easy and easy task.
So,
yeah?
The first thing is like, because you were saying, we were discussing the point like there are some kids or teens who would show hatred towards their parents because their parents are all the time fighting. So first thing is like, stop fighting in front of them, at least.
Indeed.
And then when you're reaching this point of leaving each other, then you never know how much painful it's going to be for your children.
Definitely. There are psychological impacts a lot, to a very larger scale, I would say, when the parents fight in front of their kids, in front of the children. And you know, when the fight starts, they don't care. The parents, they don't care who is in front of them.
In the surrounding.
Oh, he's just a kid. Oh, he's just a newborn. No. Like, even the newborn understands. The newborn understands what is happening.
All right.
In front of them, in front of him or her.
Right.
You see? And it's prohibited to fight in front of them.
Right.
You see? Okay, this is another story. So I would say the spouse, to those spouses, I would say do not leave each other like, or go towards divorce and stuff just because of a few issues.
Some stuff that you can solve.
Be compassionate towards each other. Compassionate is having sympathy or feeling pitiful or having concern for the sufferings or misfortunes or for the opposite person or for others, example.
Right.
This person is compassionate means that he has concerns for his suffering. He is pitiful towards the opposite person. And this quality is something which is very hard, I would say. Like, example, you hate a person and you're still compassionate towards him, like you're feeling pitiful. It's very difficult. You will never ever find like a person like you will. I would say you will not see this as an easy task for a child or a teen who says, I hate my parent, but still I'm pitiful towards him.
Right. But we have been recommended in Islam that the talent is not to forgive someone after some time passes. It's the talent is that when you are in the state of taking revenge back, mm-hmm. and you can do anything opposite, but at the same time, you forgive and forget. Thank you, brother, for being with us. Thank you, dear listeners. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help our teenagers to be more compassionate and parents to be more kind towards their children. Sure. That was all for today's episode. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Behind the scenes of major political changes across different parts of the world, large-scale and lucrative economic plans are often designed by prominent theorists or individuals working in the shadows. These plans operate in a way that aligns colonial superpowers to sacrifice weaker nations and plunder their natural resources. This is part of the speech by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, at the United Nations. It promises a grand and ambitious vision for the construction of a strategic corridor stretching from New Delhi to West Asia, a corridor that passes through the Israeli-occupied territories and reaches Europe. According to Netanyahu, this plan is to transform the lives of over 2 billion people.
This is the map I presented here last year. It's a map of a blessing. It shows Israel and its Arab partners forming a land bridge connecting Asia and Europe between the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. Across this bridge, we will lay rail lines, energy pipelines, fiber optic cables, and this will serve the betterment of 2 billion people.
To implement and exploit this plan, major changes in the geopolitics of West Asia were underway, changes which were initiated by a devastating and destructive war and the displacement of millions in Palestine and Lebanon. Perhaps the answer to the question that many ask about why Israel is unwilling to end this war lies hidden within the secrets of grand economic schemes in cooperation with the world's superpowers. Transforming the lives of 2 billion people in other parts of the world at the cost of death, displacement, and the destruction of the homes of millions in the Middle East. The idea of connecting the Red Sea to the Mediterranean and ending Egypt's monopoly over maritime passage through the Suez Canal dates back to 1956 and the Suez Crisis. The proposed plan involves a route stretching 260 kilometers, ultimately connecting the Gulf of Aqaba and the port of Eilat to the Mediterranean by crossing the Negev Desert.
Prime Minister Ben-Gurion of Israel arrives at Princeton, New Jersey to call on Dr. Albert Einstein.
one of the world's greatest scientists, the father of relativity, and the man whose physics formula led the way to the atomic explosion, plays host to the leader who played a great part in the creation of the Israeli nation.
In a document recently declassified by the United States, dated 1963, Howard David Maccabee, an American specialist, proposed the idea of carrying out 520 nuclear explosions for deep excavation in the Negev Desert. This massive project became known as the Ben-Gurion Canal. In recent years, there have been rumors about the potential revival of this project. Based on the proposal, an estimated $100 billion will be required for the project's implementation, with an anticipated annual revenue of $10 billion from vessel transit fees.
The Ben-Gurion Canal was a wild proposal made in the 1960s to build a canal through Israel from the port of Eilat on the Red Sea all the way to the Mediterranean. The idea being to create an alternative route to Egypt's Suez Canal, which already connects them.
The general design of the Ben-Gurion Canal, from a technical perspective, is envisioned as a passage with a depth and width of 50 to 200 meters and rocky walls. This design has greater depth compared to the Suez Canal and requires less maintenance and repairs. Unlike the Suez Canal, this canal is planned to operate as a two-way passage for both directions. Incidents such as several cases of ships getting stuck and the blockage of the Suez Canal have once again brought up the issue of constructing and operationalizing the Ben-Gurion Canal. If the Zionist leaders succeed in implementing and operationalizing the Ben-Gurion Canal plan, many Arab and Islamic countries in the region will become directly dependent on this project. The potential commercial benefits of this plan will gradually place these countries in a difficult and limited position in future political discussions and negotiations regarding regional developments. Some political observers have linked Israel's efforts to make the Gaza Strip unlivable and to evacuate it with removing any obstacles or resistance to the implementation and exploitation of this plan.
But what is the Ben-Gurion Canal? Well, it aims to connect the Red Sea with the Mediterranean Sea. The Gaza Strip gets in the way of all of this. If you look at the mapping, the proposed direction of the Ben-Gurion Canal from the Red Sea, from Eilat, it's kind of swerving away from the Gaza Strip. But it would be very convenient if Israel controlled the Gaza Strip and had the Ben-Gurion Canal flow through there.
Moreover, routing the canal through or even near the Gaza Strip would shorten the connection between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, reducing the overall cost of the project. In fact, the initial plan for the canal involved passing it through the port of Ashkelon, located north of Gaza. However, with the implementation of a complex security plan involving the complete destruction of existing structures in the Gaza Strip and turning it into an uninhabitable area by Israel, the starting point of the canal has been selected near the northern part of Gaza. Oceanic trade in general and the remarkable economic growth of East and South Asian countries have garnered increased attention in Israeli circles. Considering the cordial relations between Israel and India, which have evolved into deep economic and commercial partnership since the 1990s, the idea of the India-Middle East-Europe corridor, whose memorandum of understanding was signed during the G20 summit in 2023, has attracted Israel's interest. Such a project could significantly impact China's mega initiative known as the One Belt, One Road, and its efforts to establish economic influence in West Asia. Strengthening the economy of the Persian Gulf Arab countries bloc and reducing the roles of Turkey and Iran in the regional economy is considered a favorable scenario from Israel's perspective. The potential establishment of the aforementioned corridor also aligns with diminishing the significance of the North-South Corridor for these two countries. In November of 2020, rumors surfaced in the media about a secret and unannounced meeting between Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and Mike Pompeo, the then U.S. Secretary of State, at the site of NOAM project under construction in northwest Saudi Arabia on the coast of the Red Sea.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refused to discuss details of a landmark meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia that reportedly took place over the weekend.
Well, I think there is a high likelihood there was a meeting. Certainly, it could be something that happened. The American ambassador, Abizad, was with the foreign minister, and Pompeo was there, maybe in another room. MBS, the Crown Prince, met with Bibi, with Pompeo. So, you know, I think it's just a dance. But this is all the going thought is this is a message.
4 years later, amid the Gaza war, during a Likud party gathering, a proposal was raised for establishing a Gaza al-Arish Deir al-Balah free trade zone, which strengthened speculations about linking this route to the Neom project and creating a commercial hub at the intersection of the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. Considering the proposal of the Ben-Gurion Canal, the idea of connecting these two projects and placing the Gaza Strip at their junction can also be envisioned. This could serve as an incentive for Arab countries such as Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to invest in the reconstruction and administration of Gaza in the manner desired by Israel once the conflicts subside. On the other hand, extending this plan to Al-Arish port in Egypt and the Sinai Desert could partially alleviate Egypt's concerns about the diminishing role of the Suez Canal in global trade. Given the relative insecurity in the Sinai Desert and Gaza, which has impacted Egypt's national security, this project could create an additional attraction for Egypt's allies.
It's their 2035 Gaza plan to rebuild Gaza into an Israeli version of Dubai. Well, look no further than the brand new Gaza 2035 plan, which Netanyahu unveiled this weekend. Great timing, too. He's like, hey, we're about to destroy Rafah, totally eliminate about 1 million people. Here's a 9-page PDF for our plan. This is what we plan to do in Gaza, which is perfect. It's like a, you know, we want to build our own Dubai in Gaza. Perfect timing. So take a look at this. This is the new Israel 2035 plan for Gaza. Look how beautiful that will look once they rebuild it and kick all of those, all those dirty Palestinians out of there. Mm-hmm. And they'll build new rail infrastructure, new port infrastructure. It'll be easy access to all of that oil. And they'll be able to get all of this into the Middle East economy. So a place so devoid of Palestinians, of course, as they describe it. They describe it as a future where Gaza is de-radicalized from Islamism, transformed into a trade hub of prosperity and innovation, and integrated into the Middle East economy. So a place totally devoid of Palestinians, of course. According to the Jerusalem Post, it's almost like they had this plan for a while, right? I mean, it seems like they probably already had this whole thing mapped out a long time ago.
Beyond the issue of building a major corridor for the transportation of goods and energy, Israel is also seeking, in its midterm vision, to achieve secure and local energy resources. Israel's reliance on fossil fuels, reflected in the annual import of billions of dollars worth of oil from countries such as Azerbaijan, Brazil, Kazakhstan, and Nigeria, has led its government to make serious efforts toward attaining new and affordable energy sources.
This is the northernmost point of Israel's coast, its Mediterranean coast. But then, a stone's throw away, you have that Hezbollah presence. What a contrast.
The story here is the big, huge gas, natural gas reservoir in the eastern basin of the Mediterranean. As you probably know, there has been huge discovering of amount of gas offshore Israel.
Yeah.
One of the sections, called Field Number 9, is a controversial area between Israel and Lebanon, where both sides claims to have larger parts of the specific field?
The vast gas reserves along the East Mediterranean coast, a significant portion of which are located in Lebanese waters and near the shores of occupied Palestinian territories, are an attractive option for Israel. In fact, for years now, Tel Aviv has been pursuing efforts to explore and extract gas reservoirs in the waters off the eastern Mediterranean.
Their shared maritime border in the eastern Mediterranean, it's a contested area where Israel has already found hydrocarbons that can be exploited commercially, and where Lebanon is hoping to explore for natural gas.
After the discovery of the Tamar gas field in 2009, the issue of the dispute between Israel and Lebanon regarding the delineation of ownership boundaries and adjacent waters also was raised. The judgment on this matter was entrusted to UN experts to resolve the conflict.
I would like to clarify that the Karish gas field is not disputed, and it has never been. It wasn't even within the line that Lebanon submitted to the UN, which Israel did not agree to. It is not negotiable in any way. It is an Israeli gas field, an Israeli strategic asset. It's a shame. This is not constructive. I suggest that the Lebanese negotiation team proceeds with the talks. After all, it is a civilian economic issue. They should understand that and take better care of their civilians. The state of Israel has been systematically protecting its assets. The Israeli security forces are prepared for any scenario.
Israeli officials have long coveted the Lebanese section of this gas field, which is known as the Qana and Karish fields.
The first look at Israel's new off-sea gas platform. The Karish gas field is being hailed as a revolutionary development for Israel's energy production sector, and plans exist to export its gas to help ease the global energy crisis. But the site has also become a target for cross-border threats from within Israel's northern neighbor.
The efforts to incite war and weaken Hezbollah's defensive capabilities, along with the Lebanese army's strong dependency on Western countries, are also aimed at ensuring the security of the new platforms that are planned to be built in the Karish gas field in the future.
Only recently, Israel imported its energy from around the world. For the energy minister, the course is clear. Thanks to gas, the country will not only soon be energy independent, but a net gas exporter.
Currently, with the discovery of the Gaza marine ore and NOAA oil in gas fields and waters near Gaza, the importance of security in this region has increased for Israel.
That there are two gas fields under the Gaza Strip. Gaza Marine 1 and Gaza Marine 2. They were found in 1999, nearly 25 years ago. In 2000, the Palestinian Authority, that was one of the organizations that participated in this secret meeting in Geneva, they requested British Gas explore what they thought was under the Gaza Strip. And British Gas identified a 30 billion cubic meter of gas reserves under the Gaza Strip.
Initial searches for oil and gas resources in the waters near the Gaza Strip were conducted in the late 1990s by the British company BBG, leading to the discovery of the large Gaza Marine gas field located 17 to 21 nautical miles off the Gaza coast. According to the second Oslo Accord, signed in 1995, ownership of the Gaza Marine gas field was granted to the Palestinian Authority.
The problem is that Israel has not signed any related convention so far, including, and this is the most important, the Convention of the Law of the Sea. Israel is out of the international community's rules.
In 2000, a 25-year contract was signed between the Palestinian Authority and the BBG company, which led to the development of exploration activities. It was estimated the Gaza Marine gas field contained over 1.4 trillion cubic feet of extractable natural gas, which could have served as a solid economic foundation for the Palestinian Authority.
This is just one of the many reserves of fossil fuels that are in Israel, in the occupied territory of Palestine, and in international waters. Now, in 2019, the UN released a report on these fuels, stating that they were valued at $524 billion. Now, that's half a trillion in 2019 money. Under no circumstances would a Netanyahu government allow for Palestine to exploit them.
Israel's illegal occupying actions regarding energy resources and waters near Gaza reflect the long-term ambitions of this regime to access the energy resources of the Mediterranean and Gaza. These actions are carried out with the aim of imposing its policies and objectives on Palestine and Lebanon through the use of force and military power.
But if it's gas and oil, and they have a canal that's making them, could be, tens of billions of dollars profit per year, 50 billion barrels of oil under the Gaza Strip. And the strategy for the Israelis, they've said this.
One of the main reasons for the recent war and the forced displacement of Gaza Strip residents to a small area in the southern part of this region is Israel's fixation on Gaza's vast gas reserves. Following complete occupation and removal of any obstacles and resistance in this area, Israel aims to securely seize all the fossil reserves along the Gaza coast for its own benefit.
Some stories are never